a little bit more than I did before. I don't need you, but I want you back a little bit more than I knew. Now I can't go back.
Author of the Week on Literary Lusts, brought to you by Radio Gorgeous.
Emer McBride, welcome to Radio Gorgeous.
Thank you for having me.
We are here on the occasion of your second novel, The Lesser Bohemians.
That is correct.
Yeah. Your first novel, A Girl is a Half-Formed Thing, I don't know if it was a surprise to you, but it was sort of a slow burn and then boom, explosion.
It was certainly a surprise to me. It took a long time to get published, and I don't think any of us who were involved in it, in bringing out in the end, thought what would happen. Would happen that way.
Bailey's Prize for women.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think we all thought, well, if we sell 1,000 books over the course of a year, we'll be doing very well and maybe get a few little reviews. And instead, everything else happened.
Mm-hmm. And why do you think it took so long to be published?
Well, I mean, I think it was a book that was at odds with its timeline in terms of publishing. I think, you know, I got a lot of appreciative refusal letters, people admiring the book but saying that they didn't know how to sell it, or that they felt that they didn't know how to place it in the market, that the marketplace was not receptive to experimental work anymore. I think that's probably why.
And experimental in the form of its style.
Yeah, in terms of its use of language, mm-hmm. it's quite different. It's, you know, the language is about trying to capture parts of life that are usually left behind by formal speech, mm-hmm. and trying to give a fullness of experience through language of the not only the sort of the intellectual life, not of the thought process or what emotions are occurring in the person or what physical sensations they're experiencing in the moment, but all of those things together at the same time, and you know, trying to find a way of using language that was able to carry all of those things.
Yeah, because that's a style that you've continued in The Lesser Bohemians, I was trying to describe it just to myself. And instead of, you know, people like Virginia Woolf use stream of consciousness, this isn't stream of consciousness. This is sort of stream of experience.
Yeah, I think that's, or of existence, mm-hmm. simply. Yes. I mean, it's really about trying to capture the moment of being alive, mm-hmm. and whatever is happening in that moment.
And that's your narrator's voice. She's not consciously a narrator in that way. So she's experiencing her own...
Yeah.
Sort of.
I mean, there's no barrier between the reader and the character. Mm-hmm. And that was very important to me, because mm-hmm. I knew the things that I would be writing about would be difficult. And I didn't want the reader to feel in a position to make a judgment, mm-hmm. to view her from the outside, to see her as an object. I wanted them to feel as though they were her, and to just go through that experience with her. And then at the end, when they had separated back out again, decide what they thought of that experience. But in the moment of reading, I didn't want them to feel that they could judge.
But the only time I felt that you were outside of her experience is when she is outside of her experience.
Mm-hmm.
And she does, because of her experiences, she is a person who separates from herself quite easily.
Yes.
And connects back to herself through contact, through her lover's skin, through cigarette burns, through the pain of penetration. So at those moments, are points of connection for her.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think The Lesser Bohemians, though, is very different from A Girl as a Half-Formed Thing. This is a character that is able to reach out into the world and form connections outside of it in the way that the girl cannot. She is completely, you know, within herself and within her situation and will not come out the other end of that. Whereas with Lesser Bohemians, this is someone who can. And the language then changes as the book progresses in order to capture that. And as she begins to make connections, so the language begins to connect as well and changes from the language, the very staccato language of Girl is a Half-Formed Thing, into something that's much more lyrical and connected to the world.
Mm-hmm. And the form, to touch upon that, is this is a young 18-year-old girl coming from Ireland to London for drama school. And the form is that first year of school.
Yeah.
And it has that same rush of energy and pull, like me to New York, sounds like you to London as well. That party, that pull of the metropolis, that excitement, that wanting to join into this new life, this new dance of life that you're going to be a part of.
Yeah, I mean, that was really what I wanted for her, because I think, and anyone who's ever left small town anywhere for big town anywhere, understands that experience, yeah. Understands that kind of the rush of arriving, the thrill of anonymity, the, you know, the potential for excitement, and the difficulties that ensue, because, you know, you're young and naive and you don't know when to be careful and when not to be careful. And the joy of that, I mean, for me, The Lesser Bohemians, I always wanted it to be a book about joy, and it does have dark passages in it and there are dark themes to it, but it is really about joy in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it's about joy. It's about, you know, she's really propelled, you know, into this life, and she is a propelling force. She is a joyful propellant force. But part of that propulsion, I felt, and just part of that reinvention is because of shame. And part of that propulsion, you know, sexual abuse sort of ripples out and propels you in ways you may not even know.
Yeah. And I mean, she certainly, it's about going towards, but it's also about getting away. Mm-hmm. And those two things have to exist at the same time. And for her, the, you know, the thrill of London is also the relief of escaping from her past.
Absolutely. And she runs into her lover.
Mm-hmm.
But who's much older, experienced, an actor, successful where she's beginning. But that's not really that part of that relationship. They're, you know, that May-December thing isn't...
Yeah,
isn't
no, I mean, that's the setup. Mm-hmm. And in a way, it's set up in a very stereotypical way. Mm-hmm. Older man, experienced, you know, a bit sort of closed, a bit mysterious, young, enthusiastic woman, open, vulnerable... And so, you know, that's there, but that's really where it ends. It's because for me, it was about, for one thing, the two characters form, you know, carnival mirrors of each other.
Yes. Yeah.
And they also reflect back different parts of the other's life as well. Things that are missing, things that they have lost in their lives. And none of this they know. And it's all about them, you know, working towards those discoveries and finding themselves to be people they didn't know they were and capable of feeling in ways that they didn't realize they could.
Mm. Yeah, because at first, in that first crazy, you know, physical rush of love, they're sort of hiding in each other,
yeah,
you know, at first.
Yeah, and I think for him, it's, you know, for her, she's just, you know, she's young, she's full of hormones, she's dying to lose her virginity. And for him, he's older, he quite fancies her, she's available, he likes her, and he thinks, what harm will come of this? Nothing serious can happen in this situation, and let's have some fun. And that's how they begin this relationship.
That's how most trouble begins.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, she's not particularly looking to fall in love, and he's certainly not looking to fall in love. And it's about the way that, you know, this kind of the sexual relationship which starts as a very sort of friendly, casual, exploratory for her relationship. And he's, you know, it was nice to write a book about people who just like each other and are having sex with each other. And there are difficulties, but, you know, no one's taking advantage. No one's trying to destroy anyone else. They like each other and they want to be nice to each other and they have a good time together. And they don't expect to end up feeling about each other the way that they do.
And then there comes the style changes in the center of the book.
Mm-hmm.
And it is more linear. And it is sort of a monologue.
It is completely, yeah, really.
Okay, so it's not just sort of, it is.
It really, yeah, I mean, there are a few interjections, but basically it's a monologue.
Radio Gorgeous, podcasts for women.
And this is his, sort of his backstory.
Yeah.
And what's interesting, it's sort of like, you know, the Goldfinch starts mm-hmm. off with maybe a retelling, sort of in a way, of 9/11 in New York. But because it's a retelling, your assumptions, stereotypes, hackneyed responses, your sort of I know what's coming,
yeah,
doesn't exist. And you don't get to compare. And it is done fresh. So, you know, abuse of any kind, we think, oh, I know that
one.
Here
we go again.
Yeah, yeah, tick. Yeah. I know that one.
Yeah.
I know how that responds. And we don't even look at it anymore
yeah.
in a certain sense. And so what you do is, in the same way of the staccato language in the beginning, it makes you look at things. It makes you not be like, oh, okay, that's easy. That's Pat. I'm reading. No, you're just, okay, I have to actually look now.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, it was because there's, you know, there's the story that he tells, but there's also the act of telling, which is something that you don't expect from him, that she doesn't expect from him. You know, because all of the rest of the book is really about being inside her and her experience and being really close to her and what she's going through. And what she goes through in that is the act of listening to someone else, of hearing what they say. And you don't get to see him from the inside experiencing it. You only get to know what she knows. You only hear what he says and the way he describes and chooses to describe what has happened to him in his life and what she makes of that. Mm-hmm. And that seemed to me a very truthful thing. Anyone who's ever heard a story knows what that experience is like. And it would have felt dishonest to turn around and suddenly make the narrative about his internal life, because the whole point is she only knows what he shows her and what he tells her. Mm-hmm. That's all that she can work on. And so it was really important that the language completely change and just become plain spoken text at that mm-hmm. point. That's just speech. It's just about a man sitting in a room telling a woman about his life. And, you know, and I had a little bit of fun with that because I was interested to see if I could use some of those 19th century models. You know, I think there is an expansiveness to the 19th century novel that is not permitted mm-hmm. anymore. And if it's used, it's usually, you know, very marked. And that's the only thing that people talk about with regards to that book, which is also slightly ridiculous. But, you know, the novel has become such a small thing. The expectation of what it can deal with has become so tiny, unless you're some kind of great American novelist who's allowed to have deep thoughts about the universe. but everything is supposed to be, nothing dramatic is supposed to happen. And as someone who has had quite a lot of dramatic things happen in my own life, this doesn't ring true in any way. People live through big things all the time. Huge things happen in their lives, things that change them, change everything about them. And I think it's important to write about that. Mm-hmm. You know, I think there is, people are afraid. They don't want to know about the terrible thing that happens to someone else. They want to feel that that is very far away from them and that they are safe and their family is safe from those kinds of things. And it seems to me the form of the monologue, that very 19th century form, is the perfect way of writing about those things. And also it plays in with, you know, when the two of them first meet in the pub in Camden, he's standing reading The Devils by Dostoevsky, and he's reading Stavrogin's Confession. And the first conversation they ever have is about Stavrogin's Confession, which is a very interesting sort of anomaly in mm-hmm. literature, because it wasn't allowed to be published originally, or Dostoevsky was persuaded not to publish it originally because it was seen as too sordid, because it's the story of a man who rapes a 12-year-old girl. And it was thought that maybe it detracted from the great mm-hmm. politics of the rest of the novel. But really, for him, it was about trying to fulfill the human underneath mm-hmm. the role that the character played in the book. And so now when it's published as an appendix, at the end of the book and you read it separately. So only after you've read the whole novel, you then read this. And suddenly this character falls into place in a very human way that he fails to in the rest of the book. And it was, I kind of liked the thought of that, that if this monologue, you know, it works almost like a novella, it's very contained within the heart of the novel, that, and if you lifted it out completely, you would still understand the rest of the book, but you have this too. And hopefully that fills out your knowledge of who this person is and why they behave the way they do and why what happens in the novel happens.
It is very funny because it is also, it is an act of reading, but it is, and for her and also for the reader, it is an act of listening.
Yes.
And the way she is very actively holding herself back and in that way allowing this
him to speak.
Yeah.
And it's important that she does. And she knows in that moment to not. And she has all of these impulses to go and put her arms around him or to tell him that he's a good person. Or, you know, she has all of these, but she knows that what he needs is to tell her the story and she needs to just sit back and listen and let him tell the story, which is what she does.
Yeah, because most of the time you want to rush in, fix, assuage, deny.
Well, exactly. And you know, to kind of to stop it before it gets too bad, to comfort the person out of being honest about who they are. Because for us, their vulnerability is too painful. And she doesn't. And she doesn't because he has also done that for her. And she knows that.
We find out names after that moment. Why was that?
Well, I think in some ways, because the book is very connected to A Girl as a Half-Formed Thing. You know, the girl in The Lesser Bohemian, she dreams about the girl from A Girl as a Half-Formed Thing. And I have that in the book because I wanted to establish that connection openly. And say, yes, these two books are connected. They are, you know, two sides of the same coin. But whereas Girl is about the moment of trauma, Lesser Bohemians is about the life after trauma in the short term and in the long term. And so the girl in Girl as a Half-Formed Thing remains nameless because she never succeeds in becoming a fully formed thing, in becoming a woman. And that's different in this book. The moment when each character chooses to name the other has its own significance as well, but that's really what that's about the act of becoming.
Listen to us online, on your phone, download a podcast, or on your tablet. Radio Gorgeous, there for you.
I wanted to ask you about shame in particular, and being Irish and shame are somehow more connected. You know, it's like being Jewish and guilt is, you know, shame and Ireland. You know, it seemed more connected. And there was one thing I wanted to ask you what this meant. There's one point that she says, you know, something to herself, which is in smaller type. And Irish myself from what I most want.
Oh, this is the two of them are sitting in the pub and he offers to walk her home and she insists that he doesn't. And Irishes herself from what she most wants. And I think that is, you know, I think most Irish people would understand that as being the thing that your mother just says, you mustn't put anyone out. No matter what you want, you must not. So even though she's dying for him to walk her home, she doesn't want to leave him. She wants to stay with him. And he's offering to walk her home. She feels like she must say, no, 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 please don't, please don't. Which I think is a very, very Irish thing.
Yeah, exactly. Mustn't grumble with the English.
Well, you know, but you know, you mustn't ever put anyone out.
For any reason.
For any reason. You'd be lying there with bleeding stumps and no, fine. Don't mind me, please go on with your dinner. I'll just hail this ambulance, you know.
RadioGorgeous.com.
Fintan O'Toole, when he was reviewing the book in the Irish Times, I think just put it very succinctly, which is the paradox that it is shame that makes us behave shamefully. And I think that's, you know, that's very true. And that's what, you know, a large part of the book is about. It's about people coping with their own shame, about people, you know, finding themselves behaving shamefully because of their own sense of shame. Mm-hmm. And that then becoming just a huge self-perpetuating cycle is very, very difficult to get out of.
Mm. But there was ultimately, however, and in a weird sort of opposite way, I had the same feeling of as watching the film Leaving Las Vegas,
mm-hmm.
that there is a very redemptive quality of love and an essential hopefulness to love.
Yes, I think so. Well, I think it's something that is so unexpected for these characters. But also I think it is something that they understand is not a perfect thing. That love is not a solution. It's the road that you walk on, but it's not the end of the story. And there is, I think, disappointment when they discover that life continues after saying I love you, and that things continue to be difficult, and that relationships continue to be hard. But really, and I think most people have, but it's a surprise, isn't it? When you're young, especially, or when it's the first time that you're in love, you just, the way you imagine it is that love will happen and everything else will be fine after that.
Yeah, exactly. That moment of a sense, but we love each other. Yeah.
And what's next? And I think, you know, for these two characters, the acceptance of imperfection in themselves and in each other is the kind of the most profound act of love that they can manage.
And from acceptance, forgiveness. Mostly of themselves.
Absolutely of themselves. And that's, again, that goes right back to the very first conversation they have about Stavrogin's confession, about forgiveness. Mm-hmm. Who can be forgiven, who cannot be forgiven, and how you choose.
Mm. What's your source of joy?
Writing, of course. What else would it be? And it's also my greatest source of suffering, but that's to be expected, I suppose.
And is your journey because you also studied drama?
I did.
It seems to me that writing offers the ability to say so much more in one person than acting can.
Yes. Yeah, I think that's true. And I think I realized it early on that actually I was far too much of a control freak to be able to live as an actor, that I wanted to be the puppet master rather than the puppet.
Excellent. Here's to puppet mastery. And speaking of what's next for you?
Next book.
Yeah.
Next book. It's already started, just a little, just beginning, but hopefully we'll be here in less than 9 years.
Excellent. Here's the next 9 years or less.
Yes.
Yeah, you know, because you figure the bar is set pretty high. Anything, less than
anything less than that, it's a win.
Yeah, exactly. Fantastic. Excellent. Eimear, thank you so much.
Thank you.
This podcast was presented by Donna Freed and produced by Donna Freed and edited by Caitlin Hobbs.
You didn't love me no more. You didn't want me. Sit myself back on the floor and I'll